I hear somebody breathing.
Hi, it's Terry.
Hi, it's Tina here.
Hi, Tina.
Is it Terry with a T or Carrie with a K?
It's T as in Tom.
Okay, thank you. Where are you? Oh, I should ask you where you are. What part of the country are you in?
I'm outside of Chicago.
I'm over here in Tucson where it's still 96 or 97.
Oh, wow.
Hey, welcome. This is Dave. I wanted to sign on early to be sure I didn't miss any gossip. How are you guys doing?
Good, Dave. How are you?
Okay.
Great.
Okay.
Is anyone on the line who's in California?
Is
Karen on the line yet?
Yes, I am.
How are you doing with the wildfires?
Well, you know what? My daughter and her family were able to move back home yesterday.
Wow.
And we're feeling very, very optimistic. But we have a lot of friends and some cousins who have literally lost everything.
Wow.
So it's very, very, very sad. And the smoke where I live, which is about 25 miles away from the fires, the air quality has been pretty darn bad. But the last 2 days, it's been much improved. So we're grateful. I'm really grateful my daughter didn't lose her home.
Yeah,
but,
that's great.
Been
anybody else who's in California on the line? You know, we've had so many disasters. You know, here in Houston, we were hit with Harvey, and I was totally okay here at my ranch. I left, I spend the month of September in an old Creole home in a quiet part of the French Quarter writing, and I left right on the heels of that and thought I had mapped out a route there, but the internet was not updated, so what usually takes me 6 hours took me 17 hours to get from here to New Orleans. But everything was great and no problem. So I'm glad to hear that for those of you who are there. I know this has been a challenging year, and especially we're not done with all the issues in California. So it's great to have you on the call, Karen, and to know that you're okay.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Yeah. Any other check-ins, questions, things that would be helpful to talk about before we begin our seminar today? Any questions or follow-ups or clarifications from last time? You know, I wanted to mention there were a couple of emails that I got with some great questions, and these are simply things that we just didn't have enough time to talk about, and I wanted to leave time at the beginning and the end for discussion. But here are examples of some things from neuroscience that we know that make a difference in terms of things that affect decision making. And I came to appreciate the application of this in doing work individually in mentor coaching. A guy who works with high net individuals, and he was describing how he met in his office with these people. And I began to ask him some questions that in the first didn't make sense to him, like, how long do you do it? Do you have a snack? What's the timing of that? Where do you sit in relation to the client when you talk? So here are some things that I thought you might find interesting, and this is really an answer to a couple of the questions I got in an email. A study of the decision-making characteristics of 8 parole judges in Israel was reported in the National Academy of Sciences. The average parole rate was 35% across the board for the 7 years that they were studied. Now, after a mid-morning and afternoon snack as well as lunch, in other words, just after they had eaten and their glucose was a little bit higher, the parole rate was 65%. At the time their blood glucose was lowest, just before lunch and just before the end of the day, the parole rate was almost 0%. These are unconscious biases that affect decision-making. Here's another example. Emotional states can activate unconscious biases. A study of 16 years of case files of judges with bachelor's degree from Louisiana State University found that the judges gave significantly harsher sentences after LSU lost a football game that it was expected to win. And now I'll quit picking on judges. And this is just practically interesting, I think. A couple of studies out of Italy just recently showed that when someone speaks into a recipient's right ear, the response rate is 75% more successful than when they speak into the person's left ear. You know, who knew? I've been talking into my wife's left ear all these years. Be aware of coughing and other kind of background noise. Put yourself on mute if there's anything else going on, and be sure to unmute when you get ready to ask a question. And we also, the reason I ask a question at the beginning of each of these four seminars, which you'll see, I did last time and I will here, there's a reason for that. You might have guessed. I'm not going to go into the whole detail because it's interesting. There's a blog that I have that explains this. It's called the Zeigarnik effect. Zeigarnik. You'll see it's the only blog with a title like that in my archives. We remember incomplete and interrupted tasks better. So whenever you ask a question, it not only engages someone and focuses their attention, which is why we ask questions in coaching, why we may begin a presentation by asking a question, but it also engages the mind and brain focus and the desire by both the mind and the brain to want to complete the task to end dissonance and bring closure. So it keeps and sustains attention in a better way when there's a question at the end.
We're hearing background noise. Can you mute everyone?
I'm not hearing any, but if you would mute, star six for any background noise. I'll go on lecture mode when we present, but I'd like to keep it open at the beginning and the end. But be sure and mute, because you probably are not hearing the background noise, and especially if you're on a cell phone and worse, a computer connection, it'll create some static. So any thoughts or questions or things that might be of interest to for you to talk about before we begin our discussion today?
David, it's Marguerite.
Welcome. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Thanks for joining us from Canada.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
My question really relates to the time we should set our meetings, recognizing when we're also at our best state and when our clients might be in their best state. Do you have any recommendations, or do you say just plow through?
In terms of the timing of setting appointments with clients and how to get in a state of mind for that?
Yes.
Is that your question?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I think it's absolutely important. A couple of studies in a recent Harvard Business Review and Scientific American Mind that found that the most successful executives are characterized by one premier quality, regulating their state of mind and managing emotions. So this is actually what I began a new book on in New Orleans last month, is Optimum State of Mind for Performance. So the most practical way of doing that is to get grounded and centered right before you begin a call with a client. That can take about a minute of just doing a brief mindfulness meditation or a simple relaxation to get grounded and centered so that you are fully present and have full access, and to be sure that there's no distraction, no outside noise, no call waiting, nothing that's going to interrupt, so that you can be in full immersion with your client, and together you can be in full immersion. Now, when you present, for example, if you do a training, I know you do trainings or present, like a keynote, you'll want to get in a state that's optimum for that particular kind of task. You'll want to get in a more performance-oriented state of mind where you have more energy because you're putting out, everything is in an output channel there, so you want to be sure to match your state of mind to the task. So that's that, and you'll want to do something a little bit different. We'll talk more about that next time in terms of mindset management. But you'll want to do maybe a different mantra or a different getting grounded and centered when you want to go to sleep more effectively because you want to enter a different state there. So it's a matter of matching the state of mind to the task and knowing how very effectively to enter that state. So I
wonderful.
Know that's
thank you.
A little too much and compressed, but it's a great question, and we can come back to that in the next seminar when we talk about mindset mastery, especially
okay.
as it relates to our topic here. There's
okay,
also,
thank you.
For each of you who haven't seen this, there is a 30-minute, 35-minute webinar, thanks to Gloria Manchester, who nudged me to do this for her nonprofit, that's on the homepage of my website called Master States of Mind. And that really amplifies and furthers that very all-too-brief answer that I just gave. I think you'll find it beneficial if you work with clients or if you talk to people. So,
you just described my life.
Anything else?
No, that's it for me. Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else before we launch?
This is Kip, just saying hello.
Hey, welcome.
Hey, thank you.
How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing pretty well. I've been getting prepared for this, for a proposal for a healthcare outfit with docs and
yeah.
And physician's assistants, and so I've been utilizing as many of your little tips as I can to get this proposal up and running. So thank you for all you've contributed to that.
Oh, one thing I wanted to mention, and this is in response to another question about I'm going to go on lecture mode because there's some background noise. Okay, you guys can cough as much as you'd like. We're on lecture mode. This is still in response. An example of subtle aspects of influence, which is the contagion effect, how much states of mind are contagious. An example of this in everyday life, simply the amount of food eaten in different contexts. At restaurants, on average, subjects ate alone the least amount, with one other person 35% more, in a party of four 75% more, and in a party of seven or larger 96% more. And they're unaware of this, and when presented with this, would deny that they've done it. So this is another reason why simple information is not enough. So we're going to talk about the neuroscience of persuasion. So here's the persuasion quiz. Ohio State University studied several hundred undergraduates and asked them to rate how much they wanted and liked various pleasurable activities. So what do you think it was? These five things, what do you think was the most persuasive? Receiving a paycheck, seeing a best friend, engaging in sexual activity, receiving a compliment or getting a good grade, or eating a favorite food. Now, a hint, one of these was endorsed as much as the other four combined. Answers will be forthcoming. Stay tuned. So persuasion simply is an active process of choice architecture to get a prospect to clearly associate a desired feeling and outcome with your product or service. The most significant thing that great persuaders understand and communicate. It's not about you, it's about them. And remember your primary question. What is it that you want to accomplish through this? When President Abraham Lincoln was a successful lawyer prior to his presidency, he began presenting a case by establishing a positive frame for him and his clients that created a distinct advantage. He would begin his opening arguments by summing up the other side's case. He would point out the positive aspects of their position, how worthy of consideration they were, and establish his credibility by demonstrating that he recognized the other side had a legitimate view. When he presented his client's side, he established that as well and in detail. People then listened carefully because his credibility was high. The judge and jury both concluded that if he were so willing to give credibility to the viewpoint of the other side, he must be honest and speaking from his heart. This frame of respect and understanding of the other person's point of view establishes a common ground, a connection, before presenting your position. So I want to consider, in terms of persuasion science, the twin forces of all human beings, pleasure and pain. Our aversion to loss is hardwired. We learn more quickly from pain than from pleasure because negative stimuli get more attention and response. Avoiding loss has kept us alive. I'd suggest, if you have time and interest, to review my last blog called The Allure of Chaos. It's sort of timely in terms of what's going on politically now. Daniel Kahneman won a Nobel Prize by demonstrating that notions of loss are more powerful than focus on gain. He demonstrated that we register twice as much pain from losing $100 than pleasure from gaining $100, loss aversion. This means that people are more concerned with not making a bad decision than with making the best decision. From psychology and social neuroscience, we know the twin forces of motivation that drive all human behavior, the desire to avoid pain and the desire to seek pleasure. These two organizing principles of brain wiring, to minimize danger or pain and to maximize reward or pleasure, are overarching. If we associate positive emotions or reward, we approach. If we associate negative emotions or pain, we avoid. If someone buys, they associate more pleasure to buying than not buying. If someone doesn't buy, they associate more pain to buying than not buying. And we process the pleasure and pain cues unconsciously within a fifth of a second. So a master formula of persuasion: to associate buying with getting pleasure and not buying with pain. The greater gain if they do act, the loss with the failure to act. Some people will do more to avoid pain than to seek pleasure. So both avoiding pain and inertia, meaning remaining in the status quo, are the two innate brain tendencies to be aware of. Short term equals pain for all of us. Giving up their money, for example. Most people need to think long term to be successful. And think about how much of what we do is to prevent pain. Paying bills, doing taxes, exercising, maintaining your house and car. Our brains are hardwired to prevent pain, to prioritize survival over improvement. That's an abstract notion. This means that our brains are primarily a mechanism for survival rather than designed for success, fulfillment, and growth. So here's a simple pain-pleasure formula using the three story components that we talked about last seminar. The challenge: find the need or interest that's not fulfilled, what your prospects want but are not getting. The development: show how to meet the challenge. And the resolution of the story: clarify both the emotional and logical reasons to act. Now, people want emotionally, but they justify logically. So find emotional motivators. This is the part of the brain that responds and makes decisions way more quickly than the logical part of the brain. So what are emotional motivators? To have or to be the best for their clients? To have the best relationship or the best skill set? To be fully informed? To be confident? Since part of persuasion focuses on avoiding pain, if you focus on the price, this adds to their pain rather than alleviating it. We keep things to avoid the regret we would experience in giving them up. That includes our money. Participants in a research study were given a lottery ticket and then asked if they would trade their ticket for a different one with an equal chance of winning. Less than half of the participants agreed, even when bribed by chocolate. When the experiment was repeated with pins instead of lottery tickets, 90% of the participants agreed to trade. Pins are tangible and real. Lottery tickets are a story of hope. Where else can you get dopamine for a dollar? People hang on to lottery tickets to hope for the best and avoid the regret they would experience if they had switched and their original ticket won. So from a marketing perspective, giving someone $100 to be applied toward a future purpose or purchase is a greater incentive than a present $100 discount. Consumer psychology tells us that people will gravitate toward purchasing decisions that do one or more of five things. Reduce the fear of making a mistake. Make them feel more in control. Simplify the decision process. Offer clear, simple, immediate emotional benefits. And eliminate obstacles. So, now, I want to talk about six principles of persuasion. These have been shown in various ways in persuasion science to be the fundamental principles that I want you to be aware of and aware of some thoughts about application and to be thinking about application. Persuasion appeals to deeply rooted human responses of mind and brain. Strategies that simply inform people about facts and reasons to make changes have a high likelihood of failure. Information does not lead people to make decisions. Here's scientific proof that if information were enough, it would change behavior. We'd all be thin. We'd work out every day. We'd eat mostly vegetables. We'd have significant money saved. And there would be a bunch of librarians that would be billionaires. But information simply isn't enough. The mind and brain sciences can tremendously inform persuasion to determine decisions and results, though. How communication occurs, how information is communicated, can dramatically affect how it's perceived and how it's acted on. The first principle of persuasion, liking. We like people who like us, who are similar to us in some way. We buy from people we like. We prefer to say yes to people we know, like, and trust. So the application, find something in common. Discover real similarities, genuine connection, and offer authentic comments. When I was about 8 years old, it was time to buy a new coat for school. I went to the big city close to the little town where I lived on a farm out from that town. We looked at coats at three stores. That's because that's all there were. Penny's, Sears, and Monkey Ward's. Don't even ask. Because that's all there was there. At one store, I really liked the salesman. He was warm, engaging, funny, and seemed to take a genuine interest in me. The coat I was looking at there was a light blue soft velour with an elastic bottom. Sort of a balloon effect. He kind of pretty much had to be there. He said, "Man, you really look good in that coat." Nobody had ever told me I looked good in a coat before. I knew right then that was the coat I was going to buy. I just had to convince my mom. I emphasized to my mom how much I wanted that coat. Now, I didn't particularly like the coat, but I really liked the sales guy. I liked the coat even less when I got home. That salesman had done a splendid job. I couldn't grow out of that coat fast enough. For 3 years, every time it got cold, I had vague memories of a very nice salesman while I looked like my head was on top of a light blue marshmallow. Now, here's an application that I'm calling the Magic Johnson Principle. It's not in a neuroscience journal yet. When my son and daughter began playing basketball in grade school and I was coaching their teams, we had season tickets for the Houston Rockets. Two seats, and they would each do a draft at the beginning of the season to pick who went to the game with me, and we had dinner before the game. When the Lakers were in town, they were excited about seeing Magic Johnson. Before the game began, I gave them each a quiz. Notice how he plays and see what you can pick up about what his strategy is, especially about how he relates to everybody on the court. After the game, I asked each what they noticed. Now, they were 8 and 10 at this time. And to not tell the other about the answer, no trouble with that. They each mentioned how Magic seemed to be great friends with everybody on the court, including the opposing team players. What else, I asked. And the referees, they added. Anything else, I nudged. They mentioned some aspect of how much he actually fouled, but that he never seemed to be called for the fouls. Exactly. Everybody on the court likes him, all the players on both sides, and the referees especially liked him. And I was thinking, man, I really like this guy. There are a handful of people in the world who I would walk across the street to have a beer with, and he's one of them, and I'm supposed to be rooting for the Rockets. And he seemed to genuinely like them. He was as expert at handling relationships as he was the ball, and they hardly ever called a foul on him. They participated in his success. They would be less likely to feel that they participated in that success, and it would disrupt the flow of that state of mind if they had to call a foul and disrupt that good energy experience with him. In his entire NBA career, Magic only fouled out of 5 games. When people like you and sense that you have something in common, they're more likely to say yes. It's the law of attraction in action. People essentially do business with and refer business to those who they know, like, and trust. People commit not to things, but to people who they believe care about them. Now, what are the factors that cause one person to like another person? They're not all visible. Here are 4 of the most common. One is the halo effect. The halo effect occurs when one positive characteristic of a person dominates the way that person is viewed by others. Examples are kindness, honesty, intelligence. We're always teaching people how to respond to us. Similarity. We like people who are similar to us, similar backgrounds, interests, age, religion, politics. Roger Dooley, author of Brainfluence, talked about this when he was the expert content contributor at my mastermind group and illustrated it by pointing out how I used something I knew we personally had in common in my introduction of him. Compliments. By all metrics, greatest car salesman in the world, Joe Girard, said that the secret of his success was mutually liking clients. Each month, he sent every one of his more than 13,000 former clients a greeting card and a personal message. And the message never varied. It read, "I like you." And people who knew him said he authentically meant that, and he could tell you exactly what's going on with each of those 13,000 people. And finally, contact and cooperation. Things that are familiar to us are most likely to persuade. By providing people with different backgrounds with more exposure to one another as equals, they come to like each other better. Mr. Rogers carried in his wallet a statement that said, "Frankly, there isn't anyone you couldn't learn to love once you've heard their story." If any of you subscribe to The Week, there is a terrific 2-page article, the back big article on a personal relationship with Mr. Rogers that, you know, I had to, you know, try to see through blurry vision. It's really touching. We're wired to socially connect with others. A study in Edinburgh planted hundreds of wallets on city streets. The wallets contained 1 of 4 possible photos: a smiling baby, a cute puppy, a happy family, or an elderly couple. And other wallets had no photo at all. the percent of wallets that will return. With the baby photo, 88%. With the puppy photo, 53%. Family photo, 48%. Elderly couple, 28%. With no photo, 14%. The second principle of persuasion, reciprocity. We repay in kind. People return favors. When we help people, they will want to help us. This induces oxytocin, the brain chemical of connection and bonding. So the application here, give what you want to receive. Your income is determined by how many people you serve and how well you serve them. When we behave in a certain way, such as cooperatively, someone will respond in kind. We try to repay in kind what another person has provided us. It provides a sense of connection and closure. We have serious persuasive power immediately after someone thanks us. Well, of course, it's what partners do for each other. In a number of studies, reciprocity is so strong that it overwhelmed all other factors. In one study, and these are goofy examples, but they'll show you the principle. Success in selling raffle tickets was significantly more effective for subjects who received a Coke. The feeling of wanting to reciprocate to the giver resulted in buying twice as many tickets as those who had not been given the Coke. Think of the address labels you get as gift with a request for donation. In one study, shoppers at a candy store made 42% more purchases when they received a gift piece of chocolate when they entered the store. When reciprocity is meaningful and unexpected, the size of the tips that food servers receive was impacted. To diners offered a piece of chocolate at the end of their meals by the waitress, tips increased 3.3%. To diners offered to take two chocolates from the basket, tips increased to 14.1%. Now, in another scenario, after offering guests one chocolate from the basket, turning away and unexpectedly returning to the table to offer a second chocolate, tips increased by 21.3%. Now, I'm not advocating that because that sounds a little manipulative, but it's an interesting study. Third principle of persuasion, social proof. We follow the lead of similar others. Especially in ambiguous situations and when we're uncertain, we tend to do things we see other people doing, even more so if those people seem similar to us. So the application here, provide a context to guide or demonstrate adaptive behavior. Social proof is a way we determine what's correct, popular, and acceptable. We find out what other people think about it. We even view behavior as more correct in a given situation when we see others, especially like us, performing it. In a study of donations to a street musician in Washington, D.C., researchers set two situations to observe the rate of donation to the musician. And then at another match time, when someone was approaching the musician, one of the members of the study would drop some money in the hat of the street musician so that the approaching subject would see it. Viewing this act increased donation 8 times. In follow-up, not a single one of the people acknowledged being influenced by seeing the other person donate money and having it have any influence on their actions. Instead, they came up with various rational reasons, such as liking the music. 8 times. This means that basing influence strategies on what people acknowledge that influences them can have a high rate of failure. People are often not consciously aware of what influences them or what to attribute the cause. Now, add specificity. A study in Great Britain that had remarkable success of getting people to pay delinquent taxes indicated the specific number of their fellow citizens living in their zip code who were paying delinquent taxes. Focus on behaviors that are frequently adopted and that are desirable. Social proof, as well as all other influence factors, in my view, has to be both authentic and ethical. The fourth principle of persuasion, commitment and consistency. We have a deeply held motivation to behave consistently with commitments we have made, especially when those commitments are made out loud to others. The application, write down, and publicly declare a commitment. You're more likely to follow through. Consider this, and I'll bet most of you already have. What can persuade someone to keep an initial appointment with you? A series of experiments were conducted at three busy doctor's offices where patients, immediately after being provided with a date and a time in a standard appointment-making call, were asked to read back out loud those appointment details before hanging up the phone. This verbal commitment resulted in a significant increase in follow-through over those who were not asked to repeat it. A variation had an even greater effect. It was for the receptionist to simply ask the patient to write down the time and date of the next appointment on the card. The result was an 18% reduction in no-shows in that group. The best chance a commitment will be fulfilled is when there's ownership of it. There's less commitment when somebody else writes out the plan, including something as simple as the appointment time. In instances where it's not reasonable for the client to actively participate in this way, it may be more productive to get a response, such as an email, to simply check a yes to confirm an agreement. This enhances commitment rates. These are all ways to help people take ownership of their own stories and to put the commitment and the follow-through in an output channel. We each have a basic desire to be and appear consistent with what we've already done. This is the principle here, the brain principle. Once we've made a choice, we justify and rationalize that choice. We gather data to confirm it, our confirmation bias, selectively omit data that may refute it, inattentional blindness. These internal and external pressures will cause us to correspond in ways to justify our earlier decisions. We make our beliefs and perceptions consistent with what we've already decided. This principle of consistency is powerful enough to direct both our perception and our action. A desire for consistency is strong enough to be a central motivator and organizer of our behavior. So, both mind and brain incline toward the continuity of no change. A body at rest tends to stay at rest, while a body in motion tends to stay in motion. An example here is continuity programs utilize this characteristic. You give your credit card number to sign up for three free months of a subscription, you're charged beginning the fourth month unless you unsubscribe. 82% of people do not initiate the action of unsubscribing, but maintain the consistency of the subscription. As many as 62% of those remaining subscriptions are not read, but they haven't unsubscribed because that takes a separate initiative. So, how can you make positive use of this consistency principle in your business? One example, to obtain a large purchase, start with a small one as an introduction to the benefits you offer. Findings show that almost any small sale will do, like an ebook for a buck or two, because the purpose of the initial small transaction is not profit, but commitment to introduce yourself to begin a relationship. Further purchases, including progressively larger ones, flow naturally from the commitment. The small purchase initiates a relationship with the prospect. You know, another simple example is to make a single good decision to set up an automatic transfer of a specific amount of money from your checking to your retirement account the first day of each month. Fifth principle of persuasion, authority. We defer to experts and those in authority. The authority principle is really an application of the halo effect. The application here is expose your expertise. Don't assume it's self-sufficient. When you need someone to advance your case, product, or service, having an agent or an advocate can be very helpful. You're perceived as being more prestigious if someone is advocating for you. This is the idea behind book blurbs, or endorsements or testimonials from respected authorities. when you negotiate with an organization, for example. First, develop an internal champion within the organization who advocates and provides information. Thank you, Kay McConney, referenced here from all the way from Canada for this this idea of some great examples. The sixth principle of persuasion, scarcity. We want more of what we can have less of. People value things more when they perceive them to be scarce. Opportunities and objects seem more valuable to us when availability is limited. So an application here, highlight unique benefits and exclusive information. G.K. Chesterton said this very simply. The way to love anything is to realize it might be lost. Here's an application. Caitlin, my granddaughter, who was 4 at the time, was playing with a stuffed bear in her pre-kindergarten class. Sarah, her little buddy, suddenly decided she wanted to play with that bear as well. Now, there were a lot of other toys around. There was no bear deficit. But Sarah was no longer satisfied until she had Caitlin's stuffed bear. Caitlin's mother, my daughter Lauren, a clinical psychologist, was rendered as helpless as Caitlin's absent granddad Dave in orchestrating her mastery to maintain possession of that coveted bear or to work out a compromise for all-or-nothing 4-year-old possession-oriented minds. Caitlin will later learn how her own desires will be influenced by neuromarketing techniques based on celebrity induction, social valuation, and popular trending stuffed bears, even the induced shortage of specific stuffed bears. But for now, she has only impromptu strategies to wrest her bear from the evil clutches of Sarah's immediate inspired desire. As all children do, they both had a radar for scarcity, the unequal distribution of wealth, tangible or emotional. Both girls were in the grips of the scarcity principle. When something seems rare or scarce, it becomes more valuable, enhancing desire. When increasing scarcity interferes with our access to something, we react by wanting to possess it even more. Later in their lives, Caitlin and Sarah will contend with marketing messages that are adult versions of the bear story. Limited number. Only 2 left. 1 day remaining. We're not making any more. Mimetic desire. One person's desire mimicking that of another is not limited to children, but plays a significant role in product adoption of best-selling goods. Our neural system contributes to this contagion of desire. The more valued the person, the more attention we pay to that mirroring process. Now, the scarcity principle involves a secondary source of persuasion. As opportunities become less available, we lose freedom and choice, and we desire to preserve our established priorities. So we need to couple not just what would be gained by acting or purchasing, but also what might be lost or foregone if someone does not act or purchase. When increasing scarcity interferes with our access to something, we will react by trying to possess the item even more than before. A related tendency is to want what's been banned and to presume that it's more worthwhile when it's limited. In fact, Louis Neiser said, some people will believe anything if you whisper it to them. Now, many years ago, after I completed my subspecialty training in psychoanalysis, I was invited to join the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Institute. I was even more excited when I was also invited to offer a continuing education in the evening for the professional community on any subject I chose. I was warned not to be disappointed if the enrollment was low, because the highest subscription for any course that had been offered to date was 7 people. The average was between 4 and 5, and occasionally courses had to be dropped because there was not enough registration or just no registration. So the first thing I did when announcing the course was to stipulate, in order to ensure optimum discussion, a maximum of 12 seats available. I was an optimist. I didn't know consciously at the time anything about a scarcity principle. In the first 2 days, 14 people signed up and the waiting list grew. Now, here's a brief overview of these universal principles of persuasion that I've just discussed that apply the mind and brain science principles. Liking and reciprocity highlight connectedness with others to generate positive associations. Shared similarity, being and acting together, creates a sense of unity which activates the hormone of connection, oxytocin. Social proof and authority both reduce uncertainty. And consistency and scarcity both motivate action. The most important thing in knowing and applying these persuasion principles is to be authentic, to genuinely have your client's best interests at heart. Remember that all influence factors have to be genuine, trustworthy, and ethical. Now, I want to do a brief overview of four primary tools of persuasion. One is relatedness and connection. For long-term impact, you have to care about people and find a way to communicate that feeling of caring and of connection. Empathy is a listening perspective of resonating with someone else's experience, including feelings, perspective, and way of constructing meaning, especially their challenges, that person's subjective reality. Our ability to influence and persuade depends not only on our ability to empathically understand another person, but to communicate that understanding. This is always a first step, to empathically resonate with someone to build a common ground of understanding. Everything else follows. If you're not exactly right, the other person appreciates that you've attempted to understand and will correct you. When you listen empathically and communicate that understanding, the other person feels truly heard. This is the effectiveness. This is the essence of effectiveness, to be understood. The experience of connecting with another person, as I mentioned, releases oxytocin in the brain of both parties, further enhancing affiliation and trust. The more people trust one another, the greater the collaboration and shared information, sustained oxytocin. So, the answer to persuasion quiz done at Ohio State University is the option that's the generator of self-esteem. The other four are markers. The answer, the student's valued boost to their self-esteem, such as receiving good grades or compliments, more than the other four combined. Second tool of persuasion, autonomy. Having control over our environment and the choices we make generates the experience of significance, to feel important, unique, effective. When you understand what people believe and need, you can show them how your product or service will help them be effective to reach their goals and experience mastery. A third tool, certainty. The need to be certain that we can avoid pain and achieve pleasure, a basic human need. The brain is a pattern recognition machine that constantly tries to predict the near future. The act of creating a sense of certainty is rewarding. Think about how we repeat patterns. We listen to the same music. We go back to the same places we've been. We order the same item from the menu. Change generates uncertainty. Even a small amount of uncertainty cues the brain's error detection mechanism. This contributes to our resistance of change. We can increase certainty by making concepts tangible. A simple example, such as how long a meeting will run, and explicit, such as the objectives. If we're running the meeting, what are our objectives? To find out from the client what their objectives, their focus, and their takeaway should be. Much of the field of management addresses increasing a sense of certainty at times of change and transition. Whenever two people meet, the person with the greatest amount of confidence will influence the other. Confidence is a state of mind, and it's contagious. Now, these first three primary tools of persuasion comprise three of the basic six human needs: connection, autonomy, and certainty. The fourth tool of persuasion, state management, and we're going to talk all of next seminar about this. Manage your emotions and state of mind. Focus is one of the two most powerful ways we regulate state of mind. We determine someone's focus by the questions we ask. Asking questions is our most powerful tool to persuade someone. And the way we ask the question frames the answer. We're going to explore this considerably next seminar. So a final thing I want to mention, the art and science of explanation. A natural inclination is to point to all the available information and a rationale for why people should pay attention to it. Yet, when a medical doctor prescribes a medication, over 50% of all prescriptions are not filled. Of those that are filled, just over 50% are not taken as prescribed. So when you consult an expert, giving information and explaining it works in less than 1 in 4 cases, even when you're scared. Strategies that attempt to inform people into a desired change have a high likelihood of failure. It's not information per se that leads people to make decisions. Now, we all to some degree have to overcome the curse of knowledge. I know this very well. The difficulty we have in imagining what it's like to know what we know. And the killer pairing is wanting to share all that we know. One of the most profound challenges is to simplify. Although valuable, the knowledge we bring to the table, especially if we get into a teaching mode, will interfere with our ability to engage in conversation and communicate in a clear, simple, succinct way. So, in conclusion now, these following principles from a number of neuroscience studies will heighten impact and retention. The first, I've alluded to this, the four principles of good writing as well as good speaking: clarity, brevity, simplicity, humanity. When you speak to others, we know from neuroscience now, they will only be able to fully process and really retain about 10 to 12 words before their retention begins to wane. So consider the 10-10 principle. A collaborator of mine, Mark Wallman, Loyola Marymount Executive MBA faculty, did research using the 10-10 principle. Hold both fists in front of you. Raise one finger every time you speak a word. When you run out of fingers, you stop speaking. This will quickly train your brain to use 10 words in order to speak with clarity, brevity, and simplicity, since this is all somebody's going to be able to really track and retain effectively at a time. His research showed that charged situations, such as divorce, mediation, negotiation, arbitration, resolved significantly faster when this 10-10 principle is applied. They averaged 20 to 25% of the usual time that it took, and they reached more satisfying and complete conclusions. He describes this and related aspects in his book, Words Can Change Your Brain. Another, don't bury the lead. State in your first sentence what problem you address, then the benefits you bring. Listen carefully. Knowledge speaks, wisdom listens. Reduce the noise. Include only what is simple and relevant, the essence of what you want to say. For example, if you ask a question, make it clear, specific, succinct, 10 words or less, then pause. Don't elaborate, explain, or stack on another question. And have fun. States of mind are contagious. Many of you have heard me repeat this. My favorite grandmother said, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. Now, in your outline, there's additional information on your unique position, avatars, ecosystems, and watering holes. And I included that there and know that we don't have time to discuss, and I wanted to preserve our time at the end for discussion, so I'm going to ask you to manage the background noise, be on mute until you ask a question or speak. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. Thoughts, questions, clarifications from anyone?
It's Marguerite.
Yeah, please, go ahead. Thanks.
I guess the part that I think is a killer for me is sharing too much. And so, and I understand the technique of using the 10 to keep the communication very brief. However, if...
By caring too much?
Mm-hmm.
You said you have a challenge caring too much. Is that what you said?
Communicating too much.
Oh, communicating too much. Okay.
Yes, yes. So communicating in a clear, succinct way is my challenge.
Okay. Remember that when you communicate with information and telling somebody all that you want them to hear, that's your issue. You need to focus on their issue and decenter mm-hmm. to focus from their position. So first, and we know this from coaching someone, the first thing we need to do is to resonate empathically with their experience, because state always comes first, then strategy and story. You know, we hear from somebody and we immediately launch into figuring out a strategy or figuring out a story. The first thing we need to do is to establish a common ground of listening from inside the client's perspective to resonate empathically, which will also help them regulate a state of mind. If they mention something, you know, this has been upsetting, or this is overwhelming, or this is so much stuff. So instead of immediately jumping into the strategy about how to deal with all this overwhelming stuff, the first response, I would suggest, needs to be an empathic resonance with their state of mind.
Yes.
And say simply, I hear how overwhelming this has been mm-hmm. for you. And just that statement may help them self-regulate and self-reflect to be in a more grounded and centered place, to be able to participate with you, because from that grounded and centered place, that self-regulated place, we have much more capacity to self-reflect, to have mm-hmm. access to all of our states of mind, and not just the information in one state of mind, one software program, that may be booted up by a particular reaction to a certain situation. So keep in mind, it's not about information, it's not about all you know, it's about the experience of the person you're talking to. When you address the experience first, then you're going to be able to go someplace new together, informed by all the things you know, but that's not the objective, to instill or to pour your wealth of wisdom into that person, but to co-create a story in which you are facilitating the story that's developing by the client. You're not ghostwriting it. You're not running in plays.
Mm-hmm.
You're
mm-hmm.
the catalyst to that story. Remember from high school chemistry, the catalyst engages but doesn't enter into the reaction. So you're mm-hmm. not ghostwriting the story to seriously mix metaphors here. Marguerite, does that help you with...
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay,
thank
super.
You.
Other thoughts or comments? Any other clarifications to any things that that we talk about? One thing that focus does, and to look at clarity, brevity, simplicity in terms of focusing, focus aligns the energy field of someone's brain. So when you help them focus on something, they are in a much more receptive position. They are aligned to receive information and to collaborate with you in achieving that. So that's why an empathic resonance, and remember we talked about last time, that initial resonance needs to be with their challenge, to look at where they are, because we need to join the client with their experience rather than asking the client to join us and to listen to us talk about all that we know. So this is the initial perspective, is from the experience of the client, and this can be individually or a group. And this is also why you want to think, bless you, this is why you want to resonate with someone's experience and have in mind how they're hearing things. So their associations to what you say are going to put them in a particular state of mind. So if you speak of something as cost or price in an offering, that's associated with the loss of resources. Instead of speaking of purchase or investment, that may be associated to gain and to benefit. So everything that you say is important because it's going to be important to the client to be able to participate in an optimum, maximum way in what you know and what you have experience in knowing that they will benefit when they engage you. So your first challenge is engaging them and then going someplace new together. Thoughts, comments, questions?
It's Marguerite again.
Okay.
So you gave an example as you were speaking earlier about a client, another example about a friend, and of course about your granddaughter. So if we are with a client, we could also be using examples from other clients without obviously naming names, which would form that relatedness to a particular situation. Am I right?
I wouldn't agree with that statement.
Okay.
And here's why. Now, one of the things, as a preface to this, one of the things that I find and do with clients is that I am much freer to tell stories and to tell stories about me, about other people, than I ever was in therapy and analysis. But the purpose of a story is to illustrate or amplify a principle to help a client further the working aspects of what they're doing. Now, if a story is notably about another client, even though you preserve anonymity and confidentiality, if I'm a client, I'm wondering if you're going to use me as an example, and I don't want even for a stutter step of 3 nanoseconds to be distracted like that. So
yes, yes.
I would reference it in a way that incorporates it in a story, but it's not evident at all. It's taken from another client.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to you?
Yes, so we could create a scenario
that's an
or something like that.
An example of being aware of a client's association to something. We need
yes.
to be aware of a client or a group to be sure that not only do they understand the context and the format of something. We need to paint a picture and create a scenario that we know we're all in the same room speaking in the same way, so they know where we are and what the, you know, what the environment's like, so they don't have to assume and they don't have to wonder where we are or where you. So this is part of an empathic resonance. This is sort of social and emotional intelligence of bringing someone along with us. We also want to be aware that we don't use trigger words or association words that a client or a group may have certain associations to, as far as we can be aware, that would be distracting in any way from the total immersion in what we do. And that's as important as not having background noise when I'm working with a client. A client is not going to hear my pool people or my gardener, you know, talking in the background or starting a machine in the background, because that's distracting to me and it has to be to them. So that's going to have a purity of a framework, and be aware of the associations that someone is going to have so that you are able to help someone engage in a sustained immersion in the discussion for optimum success.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're out of time. If there are any questions, comments, clarifications that we didn't get to, fire them off to me in an email. And welcome to those of you who have joined and registered late. I hope this has been helpful. I hope you had a good access to the recorded version. This should be available for recording, for playback tomorrow. We'll pick up right here next Monday. Thanks very, very much.
Thank you, Dave.
See you guys.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.